The following podcast contains strong language and frank conversations about topics that some listeners may find upsetting.
I don't expect every teacher out there to be an HIV expert. That's ridiculous. How can we ask that of them? But I do expect them to take the responsibility that if you're choosing to bring this subject up in your lesson, that you're doing everything you can to ensure that the information you provide is accurate. And that can mean, you know, not taking the position of the expert and not saying, I know what I'm talking about, when you might not.
Welcome to Positive Advice, the podcast from Cheever. And if you aren't aware, Cheever supports children, young people and young adults growing up with HIV to become healthier, happier and more in control of their own futures. We promote young voices and give them the opportunity to reshape the discourse around HIV. I'm Eli Fitzgerald, your host for this series. And this time around, we're focusing on education and schooling. And I'll be picking the brains of some experts as we all share our experiences of growing up. As always, I'm joined by a professional in this field as we try and improve the lives of young people living with HIV. This time, I'm joined by Camilla Gordon. Can you tell us a little bit about your work with young people living with HIV and just expand more on what you do?
Yeah, of course. So I've worked with young people living with HIV for probably 6 or 7 years now with a number of different organisations, predominantly with Cheever in the last 5 years, working as a volunteer on camp initially. And more recently, I've got involved with the Cheever Youth Committee, supporting and facilitating residential weekends, working with the campaigns group to help the young people develop a toolkit for schools, and also facilitating a weekend for young adults to help them shape the future of Cheever support for young adults who've grown up with HIV.
Could I also ask you what sort of challenges the young people you support face?
Yeah, of course. I think there's a range of challenges that the young people we work with face, particularly around school. School is obviously a place where you spend a huge amount of your time growing up, and it's a real formative experience, both in terms of education, but also in terms of forming relationships and a sense of identity. And what we really see is the challenges that young people face, particularly in school, are obviously a huge amount related to stigma. We hear examples of young people struggling to manage their health around appointments and having to do visits outside of school and having to explain that to schools. A huge amount of misinformation, sometimes from young people, but also quite often from teachers themselves. And then, of course, the stigma that they face every day in relation to comments and jokes when people aren't aware that there is a young person living with HIV around them.
And then I guess maybe just the additional stuff that happens when you're a teenager going through school, which is already tough as it is.
Exactly. You know, as a teenager, you're thinking about starting relationships and having sex for the first time. And those are huge experiences for any teenager. But for young people growing up with HIV, there is an additional thing that they have to think about. And they're not only thinking about that in terms of themselves, but also their potential partners, but also beyond that in relation to their families. Particularly if they're thinking about sharing their HIV diagnosis with someone, quite often they're not only sharing it for themselves, but also sharing it for their families. And that's a huge responsibility to put on anyone, let alone a young person who's growing up and trying to find their way in the world.
Also with us is Amanda Ely from Cheever. Welcome back, Amanda.
Hi, Eli. Hi, Camilla.
Is there anything you would like to add on to what Camilla just talked about the challenges young people face living with HIV whilst going through school?
Yeah, I think I'd just pick up on the point Camilla made that, you know, for children and young people, school is such an important place. You know, if you think about your day, you're often spending more time in school than you are at home. And it's hugely significant. It's where, you know, all their sort of peer relationships are developing and growing. It's not just about providing education. We know that. It's about a lot of kind of social learning and relationship development is happening in schools. And HIV is part of that, is part of what young people are navigating in that space. And if you go to school and you hear misinformation about your HIV, which unfortunately we do hear happening a lot, that can be harmful. It can be upsetting. And it's very difficult for young people to navigate that because speaking out is really hard as well. And the sort of, you know, Camilla referenced the whole way stigma can kind of appear in schools with playground taunts or, you know, oh, you're going to catch AIDS in the playground. That sort of, you know, we might see it as silly, childish games, if you like. Yeah. But actually, if it's you, if that's a health condition that's your diagnosis, those things can be harmful and hurtful and really difficult to kind of deal with.
I remember my school having this really wild rumour that the river in the town had AIDS. And if you went swimming, that's how you contracted HIV.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, who makes this up?
Yeah.
Whose brain has worked this out? But yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that, both of you. Now, this episode is exploring the role education plays in young people's lives. On Positive Advice, that means amplifying the voices of young people living with HIV. To kick us off this week is Barbara, who spoke to us at the 24th International AIDS Conference in Montreal.
I left the village. I went to Kampala. Kampala was a bit strict because we had a fenced house, so it wasn't easy to go out or get boyfriends or anything. So I had a chance to focus a little on school. I finished my primary school. I went to secondary. It was a girls' school only. So even there, it was kind of controlled. But later on, I had to go back to Fort Potro to another school, which was mixed. And there it was like letting me to do what I wanted to do all over again. So I remember having multiple sexual partners again, and I got pregnant at age 15. So I didn't know I was pregnant. I just thought I was growing fat. So everybody in the school knew I was pregnant except me. So they told my family. I remember my stepmom coming with another friend. They took me to hospital and terminated the pregnancy at 8 months. So I didn't really know what was going on. All I know is there was a baby. I don't know where that baby is because they asked me, do you want that baby? I said no. You know, you've been through a lot of pain and someone is asking you, do you want a baby you didn't even know you had, and you just had a baby come out of you. So, yeah, they did whatever they did, and the next day they took me back to school. You know, the worst part was they took me from school with a very big stomach. They brought me back to school with a flat tummy. So I faced a lot of stigma. I was discriminated against, like, nobody wanted to associate with me anymore. So I felt so alone. I wanted to leave the school, but I could not leave the school. So I had to burn my mattress at the school, and I was expelled because I just wanted to find something that could get me out of the school. So when they expelled me, I had to come back to sit my senior four exams. That is like O-level. And I finished. I passed well. Compared that, I was very wild and all that. I was really good because I was the best in English and in literature. Yeah. So if I had concentrated, or if I had been guided, or if I had someone to show me the right things to do, I would have performed even much, much better.
So we heard there about how Barbara sort of really went in depth about her difficulties of experiencing school, but how she then went on to succeed in school after being expelled. And my question is sort of to Camilla first. Do you think there is a lack of understanding of the needs of people living with HIV within education systems?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's just a general lack of understanding of HIV in general, let alone around the specific needs of young people living with HIV. I think we see quite often that when schools are aware of a young person's HIV diagnosis, that they respond from a place of fear. And quite often that means that more people are informed and that young person's right to privacy is violated. I think that it means that young people are much less likely to share when they need help and what help that is. I think a huge part of that is because of the stigma associated with HIV. We've seen examples where a young person has shared their HIV diagnosis, and that's been passed around a number of different staff members under the guise of safeguarding. And while I understand the importance of safeguarding, living with a long-term health condition isn't related to safeguarding in this context. And I think that if more staff at schools really understood HIV and understood it as a long-term health condition, the whole approach would be very different. I think also there's a challenge around a lack of trust in young people in general. So when a young person says they have to go to the hospital or they have a doctor's appointment, we quite often see there's a distrust around that. And so we see them being asked multiple questions about where are they going, why are they going there, which, again, doesn't help anyone when it comes to trying to build trusted relationships for young people who do maybe want to talk about living with HIV to a member of staff. I think that really puts a barrier up to young people being able to ask for help and schools being able to provide that help and support.
So, Amanda, I want to ask you the same question. Do you, in all the years you've sort of been working with young people living with HIV, have you noticed there's a lack of understanding within education systems?
Yes, unfortunately. And I think there's been some sort of larger scale surveys as well on public knowledge of HIV more generally, not just in schools. And we also did a survey of school staff a few years back when we were first providing some guidance around HIV for schools. What's found in both these kind of larger scale surveys is that people's knowledge of HIV tends to be outdated. So people tend to have some knowledge around HIV, but it's sort of what we might remember from the very early days of the pandemic. People will reference the Tombstone advert, for example, when you're of a certain age. You remember that, you know, and it was at the time designed to alarm and shock and kind of terrify people into you know, using condoms. And so its purpose then is something that people remember now. So the association of HIV is fear, it's death, it's, you know, this really seriously sort of dangerous disease. Don't die of ignorance was the slogan. And that's what people refer to, unfortunately, still now. And so we've got a really outdated understanding of HIV. We've got reference points which were designed to sort of make people be worried, really. There's urgency around that. And then we've got, you know, a sort of, particularly for young people, we've got a relatively small number of young people growing up with HIV in the UK. So we've got another problem, which is people thinking they don't really need to know about this. And it's quite hard at Chiva when we're trying to disseminate awareness raising, you know, training or getting resources used in schools, where many schools may never encounter a pupil who's living with HIV. So it's like, well, why do I need to, you know, give up my time to send staff on training around this issue? Why should I pay attention to this when I've got so many competing issues that I'm contending with on a day-to-day basis? And that's very understandable. But what it does mean is for that individual young person who ends up in that school, they might be in an environment where people's knowledge is really poor. They've got no policies around confidentiality, ensuring that there's appropriate support in place. And they're just running a risk, really, of what kind of experience they're going to have. And that's not good enough. You know, every child's individual needs should be met in a school, but it is challenging.
Definitely. And I think there's a lot of stigma going around still in schools. And I think, you know, Barbara spoke quite a bit about that feeling of being stigmatized because she was living with HIV. And sort of, Camilla, I'm going to ask you first, how would you address the issue of stigma with HIV and teachers?
Well, for me, I think it comes back to actually going back to basics and just addressing stigma in general. I think over the last few years, we've seen a real move in terms of what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable in and around schools. There's certainly language that was thrown around quite often while I was in school that would no longer be acceptable in any way today. And yet, as Amanda already said, AIDS is still thrown around as a slur, to make a comment on someone. And yet we see time and time again, it's not called out by schools or by staff. So for me, it's about recognising the stigma, wherever it is, needs to be called out. I think particularly around HIV, it's about education for the teachers.
Yeah.
I think there's a real sense in schools that because someone is a teacher that they are always right. And actually, where are we supporting teachers to learn, to keep learning, and to recognise where they have been wrong? A challenge we hear quite often from young people is when misinformation is given out by teachers, they don't know how to challenge it because they know it's wrong, but they're sat in the back of the class thinking, oh, if I call this out, people are going to ask me, how do I know that? Mm. Am I then going to be outing myself in a situation that I don't want to be and where I'm not comfortable? And so I think for me, it's looking at how are we teaching HIV in schools? Why is it only being taught in sexual health, for example? HIV is a long-term health condition. And why is it not being framed like that? And I think while it remains a subject that is part of a much more taboo topic of sexual health, that stigma will remain. And unless teachers are ready to challenge their own biases and really understand where they come from, it's much harder to be able to challenge that stigma in schools. And I think we also see a lot of young people living with self-stigma that comes as a result of being surrounded constantly by that external stigma. And I think, again, this goes bigger than just HIV, but until a teacher can stand up and say, actually, do you know what, I was wrong? Or, you know, I went away and learned about this because you asked this question. Here's some information. We're not role modelling to young people how they can go away, learn and change their minds and improve. And so for me, it is a much bigger issue than just around HIV, but it's also so pervasive across so many different areas. And so for me, it does all start with education. And Chiva has a number of resources that are really useful. So we've got a school's toolkit, which was actually co-designed by a group of young people, specifically targeting the areas that they wanted teachers, staff and their peers to know. So using that, we've seen a number of schools and colleges use it really successfully, but also Chiva's guidance for schools, which I think helps to frame for teachers how to have some of those conversations, how to improve their knowledge. Once we start seeing more schools looking at that, understanding that and implementing those things, then that's when we'll start to see change.
I completely, you know, would echo many of Camilla's points there about what we need to do more generally, I guess, in terms of thinking about how stigma for all sorts of reasons can persist in communities like schools, and how we need to be able to encourage a kind of a challenge of such poor use of language or inaccurate information that can be accessed in schools, which just disadvantages children, really. It really does affect their kind of whole learning experience. And the way in which schools are set up, where, like Camilla said, you know, the teachers are in the positions of authority, they're the knowledge bearers, and the children are supposed to just sort of sit and listen and passively accept everything. And actually, if we could generate in our schools much more of an environment of kind of debate and discussion and research and fact-checking and constantly kind of being minded to check what is the most accurate and up-to-date information here. So if you're approaching a subject like HIV in a lesson, you know, the collective task would be to kind of, what can we find out? What do we know now? And how can we ensure that what we know now is accurate? And bringing children along with you in that learning journey, because it's hard to expect teachers to be expert in everything and to be up to speed with everything. I don't expect every teacher out there to be an HIV expert. That's ridiculous. How can we ask that of them? But I do expect them to take the responsibility that if you're choosing to bring this subject up in your lesson, that you're doing everything you can to ensure that the information you provide is accurate. And that can mean, you know, not taking the position of the expert and not saying, I know what I'm talking about, when you might not. The experiences I've had at Chiva where it's gone really well, I can think of an example where they became aware that a young person in the school had HIV. They weren't told by the family, but a previous school told them. They shouldn't have done, but they did.
Yeah.
And the head of that school said, I'm not equipped here. I've never experienced this before. I don't know what to do. So instead of immediately emailing the whole senior leadership team and the head of governors and everything else, which has also happened, this teacher went straight to the internet, did some research, and actually, fortuitously, I think, found Chiva. And we said, oh, well, actually, we've got some guidance. Here you go. Here's some guidance. And then we said, do you need some support? You know, how can we help? And he's like, well, actually, really do with some support. So we had some joint meetings with the parent, and it was okay. You know, there was no panic, and the young person's confidentiality was not further breached, which was really important. The parent was reassured that actually this information is safe. And I now know that my child has these two identified members of staff in the school that they can talk to at any point should they need to. You know, but that's because that leader in that school recognised, okay, I need some guidance here.
Just following up on that, I think it's important to recognise that while we do have a huge number of examples of poor practice in schools, there are examples of brilliant practice. And an example I can think of is, again, a teacher became aware of a young person's HIV diagnosis and reached out to clinical professionals to have that conversation. And the young person went from being terrified that their school knew or that someone had found out to actually receiving a huge amount of support. And that teacher had no knowledge of HIV. But again, as this head teacher did, they recognised that. And rather than panicking, they said, OK, let's look at this. And I think it's really important to recognise that there is great practice out there. There are really great supportive teachers who are doing an incredible job to support young people living with HIV. But beyond that, to address stigma. That's all that we really ask for, is recognising where you don't know what you don't know and asking for help.
And also, it must be so life-changing and supportive to just have one person in a place where you go every single day to know that they're there, you can talk about this, and it's not, you know, like talking with your parents who might necessarily not be in that space to talk about it, but you're at school, if you're having a bad time, you can talk to that one person. Now it's time to hear another clip from the conference in Montreal, this time from Portia, who has this to say about her education.
And then I also had a sexual health education presentation in middle school, my seventh grade year. But this was in class with all the other students. And I think that's when I was first introduced to the stigma. Because my family never treated, if anything, they gave me more special attention and gave me more special care than the rest of my cousins and stuff. So. And I don't think they ever treated me, like, different that I can remember, at least. But I think the first time I was introduced to the stigma was when I got that sexual health presentation from my case manager, and then when I got into middle school, and they taught sexual health education to us in middle school. And then I was able to hear the other kids' responses to what we were learning, and I just was quiet the whole time in class. Like, I didn't say anything, but I just remember the images they showed. I was like, well, that's not, I'm, you know, like, that's not me. Like, they didn't talk about medication and how the treatment works, and that was like a big thing for me. I wish that they would have talked about, you know, and it was kind of just like scary. They showed all the scary pictures of all the STIs, and the pictures that they were showing of HIV were like, you know, people wasting away and dying. And yeah, it was just like negative. So that's when I realized, oh, there's a stigma behind my experience. And I probably shouldn't like talk about it like that, because it's not looked at in a good way, you know. So
Camilla, listening to that clip, I was wondering if you have any instant reactions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually the story that Portia shared isn't that different from a lot of stories we hear at the moment, from how young people have experienced HIV being brought up in schools, number one, but also the response of peers. And that while misinformation from teachers has a huge impact on young people, it's actually the response from peers that I think is much more damaging to young people's sense of self, self-identity, but also their mental health.
And we know that Portia's school experience was some years ago, but I was wondering whether you had any opinions on whether you think attitudes have changed since then.
Hearing Portia talk about how her peers reacted is certainly something that is really reminiscent of a lot of stories we hear. We had a young person recently who was thinking about telling a friend, and we spent a lot of time working with them, trying to build up trust to help them shared their diagnosis with this friend. And during a class, HIV was discussed, and this close friend made a comment about how people living with HIV should drink bleach. You can only imagine the impact that that had on the young person. And to make it even worse, the teacher didn't challenge it.
That's heartbreaking.
I mean, it's so many things. And for that young person to hear that from the one person that they had decided they were going to trust with their health and sharing their story for the first time outside of the family, outside of being in an environment like Chiva where they can talk about living with HIV openly, to hear that, first of all, is devastating. Mm-hmm. Secondary to that, is it not being challenged by teachers? And when attitudes like that are shared, the idea that someone in a position of authority, as Amanda has said, hasn't challenged that, what does that do to a young person's sense of self and identity and ability to trust? And I think time and time again, we see how as young people grow up into young adults, trust is a huge, huge issue because the people that they have trusted before in many ways have let them down, whether or not they know that they've let them down because, you know, their friends didn't know that they were sat next to a young person living with HIV. And yet they still shared these horrific, horrific comments, which we know will have been picked up from somewhere else, whether that's from social media, whether that's from other people in their family. And that is all influenced by stigma. So while I think broadly attitudes and practices have changed, I mean, we've had huge advancements in the last few years. Ultimately, the challenges being faced by young people in schools or in education settings or with peers is completely influenced by the sort of attitudes that set the experience that Portia had.
From back when I was at school with that story about, you know, AIDS being in the river, which I still think is wild, to like today and that's still going on. And albeit I'm not that, like I'm still a young person, but, you know, we're talking 10 years and there's no change and that's not acceptable. So Amanda, I'm going to ask you the same question. Do you think things have changed at all?
I think I probably feel similarly, you know, that it's a bit of a two steps forward, one step backward. Certainly, the way in which, as professionals, we approach our relationships with schools has developed. And I think that we are now much more kind of inclined to say, well, look, in this particular situation, this family are feeling that some extra support would be helpful, that we can work, you know, with you, with the school, and we'll try and help you to tell the school and make that happen in the best way possible. And that can actually have some really good outcomes in terms of support. So I think that there's movements there to recognise that we can't persist in treating HIV so differently from we would any other needs that a child might be presenting at school with. Because if we do that, then we really disadvantage the child because they don't get access to the extra support that the school may well be able to provide really helpfully. However, alongside that, there is concern that in the classroom space or in the school community space, there isn't going to be anybody who's going to step up and speak out when they need to, when some of these horrible experiences happen. Like, and I think it's a general cultural need that we have in schools, that schools should be sites of social justice where anything that is affecting, you know, somebody's well-being and somebody's worth as an individual human being is not, you know, it should be called out. Yeah. And I think that's so important. You know, when we're kind of, we're making some progress in other areas. And I think that, you know, when one hopes that from particularly events in recent years, that kind of there's going to be less, well, there should be zero tolerance of racism in schools, but we want there to be zero tolerance of any kind of inequity or any, you know, any issue of social justice and equality should be called out in school, because that's what we're talking about here. You know, it's not okay to use slurs in playground about somebody's, whether they have a health diagnosis or not, and to think that that's a form of entertainment, or, you know, when we know it's really hurtful and harmful for children and their families.
Now it's time to check in with Ruth from Chiva, who's been speaking to our young people to share their thoughts on education and schooling. Thanks for coming, Ruth.
You're welcome.
When listening to these clips at the recent Chiva workshop, what were the key things that people wanted to talk about?
So one of the things that came up was when we were listening to Portia's clip, and there was an anecdote that was shared by one of the young people about their experience in school. And they shared about a time where it was a biology class or something that was being taught, and they were learning about HIV, and there was some misinformation given by the teacher. And this young person very bravely corrected their teacher very politely, and that resulted in the teacher obviously getting quite upset, getting quite angry, telling off the student, and also their peers laughing at the student for trying to correct the teacher. And that left the young person feeling quite embarrassed, quite ashamed, and also quite deflated in the fact that they tried to educate their friends and their teachers and it didn't work. So my question is just, what are you guys' thoughts on that?
Thanks for sharing that insight. And sadly, I think it's not a unique story. And it's one that we hear quite often from young people. I think that it really shows the importance of educating both teachers and staff in schools, but also why this sort of education shouldn't just be limited to young people living with HIV. Mm. I think it's really important that we continue to challenge when we hear something that is incorrect, but also recognise that it shouldn't be the responsibility of a young person living with HIV to correct everyone around them. Mm. And that's why I think it's so important to keep having these conversations with people who aren't living with HIV, because they need to be being advocates and challenging it where they see it. It's not just happening in classrooms. It happens everywhere in the world. And when a friend or a colleague makes a comment, how are you stepping up as an individual to challenge that and not letting the burden of correcting all the misinformation in the world around HIV to people living with HIV, and particularly young people living with HIV. The more we can start to be ready to be challenged on things, the more likely we are to create a society where when something does get challenged, rather than it being a get out of my classroom situation, I know two or three young people who've been thrown out of class for challenging the teacher. It shouldn't be a scary thing being challenged.
And I think this is where endorsement of information being developed and provided for use in schools becomes really critical, because if we can ensure that resources that are used in schools to educate on, you know, any array of particular topics, but for our purposes, HIV, is endorsed, and therefore we have a way of ensuring that information is accurate and up to date. You know, one of the things we've been trying to do is to get the school's toolkit and the practice guidance that we use endorsed by the Department for Education and have it shared on their website. And therefore, you know then that schools can be directed to a verifiable source of information. It's been verified as being accurate, up to date and suitable to be used in schools. And you can try and sort of in that way, you know, quality assure, if you like, your lessons to ensure that information is correct. And I think that it's about what importance you're giving to the information you're providing in your lessons, and recognising that what children learn from you, you know, they take with them and they hold, and then that impacts, you know, all sorts of things in their lives, how they might respond to appear in the future.
Yeah.
You know, if that young person in that classroom has had misinformation about HIV, and a few years down the line, they're with a partner who shares their HIV status with them, that education then impacts, you know, on that relationship and how they respond. And so these things always have consequences. And we need to understand that, I don't know, a PSHE lesson, for example, has equal value and significance and importance in a child's life to a maths lesson. You may not be getting your GCSE grades in PSHE because it's a required part of the curriculum, but people aren't examined in it. It may not be helping the school with their league tables of how many people are getting the grades they require. But it's hugely important when we're talking about equipping young people in life to manage all sorts of things. And until we recognise that role that schools play in preparing young people for life, not just preparing young people for exams, we're not going to get the same importance, you know, placed on these sorts of topic areas, because it's like an add-on. It's like, you know, you do it in tutorial at the end of the day and, oh, here's who can do this. Oh, anyone can do this. Well, no, not anyone can do this.
And then you just get 10 minutes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Another experience was shared that was raised by young people we spoke to was the lack of support received when they needed time off for medical appointments. The feelings raised were that they were feeling penalised for having poor health. So my question is, why do you think this is, and how can schools support young people when they need to take time off school?
I think it's a story we hear a lot. When so much weight is put on attendance and no flex is given as to why attendance might be missed, it means that this narrow focus of schools on this tick box exercise of being in school, it adds to the pressure not only for the young person who actually wants 100% attendance. They want to be there, but they have to go to their appointments. They have to look after their health. And so when you have such a narrow focus, it also means that staff and teachers are much less likely to take a responsive approach when a young person says, hey, I need to take some time off. Mm. The other side of it is where young people have to go to request that time off. And we've talked quite a lot about teachers and education here, but I think actually the conversation here is around staff in general. And if you're having to talk to someone who isn't necessarily your teacher but might be on reception, they then become a gatekeeper to you being able to have a conversation about why you need to go to the hospital or go to the doctor. And as I've said before, this mistrust of young people, they're trying to get one over on us, they're just trying to get out of school, all that does is add to the stigma and to the shame around this idea that you shouldn't be going to the hospital, you know, you shouldn't be going to the doctor, or I don't believe you. Mm. And when you add into that other factors that might influence that. So, for example, we know that Black children are treated differently to white children, and how a young person who is of a different sexuality or a different gender might be treated differently. And we look at the intersection of all those different elements that just builds the challenge and the barriers to a young person going to ask for help and support when they're being treated as if they're already doing something wrong. When we know, actually, going to the hospital, taking your medication, as you've already heard in other episodes, all these things are hard enough as it is without putting up another barrier and another added weight of my teacher doesn't trust me.
Yeah.
Thanks both for sharing such an insight on the questions that Ruth asked in response to what the young people said around those clips. Thanks to everyone for listening to Positive Advice. I'm Eli Fitzgerald, and thanks to Amanda Ely, Camilla Gordon and Ruth Muko for joining me. In our next episode, we'll be chatting all things relationships, and we'll be further adding to this oral history collection we're creating. If you want to learn more about Chiva, or if you want to access clips and updates from the Positively Spoken project, then head to chiva.org.uk and follow the links there. Positive Advice is a TBI media production for Chiva.